The phone rang. Mrs. Harvey had coded, and the ICU team was attempting CPR. I raced back to the hospital, and once again, she pulled through. Barely. This time, instead of going home, I grabbed dinner near the hospital, just in case. At 8 p.m., my phone rang. Mrs. Harvey had died. I went home to sleep. I was somewhere between angry and sad. For whatever reason, Mrs. Harvey had burst through the layers of paperwork to become my patient. The next day, I attended her autopsy, watched the pathologists open her up and remove her organs. I inspected them myself, ran my hands over them, checked the knots I had tied in her intestines. From that point on, I resolved to treat all my paperwork as patients, and not vice versa. In that first year, I would glimpse my share of death. I sometimes saw it while peeking around corners, other times while feeling embarrassed to be caught in the same room. Here were a few of the people I saw die. 1. An alcoholic, his blood no longer able to clot, who bled to death into his joints and under his skin. Every day, the bruises would spread. Before he became delirious, he looked up at me and said, "It's not fair. I've been diluting my drinks with water." 2. A pathologist dying of pneumonia, wheezing her death rattle before heading down to be autopsied, her final trip to the pathology lab, where she had spent so many years of her life. 3. A man who'd had a minor neurosurgical procedure to treat lightning bolts of pain that were shooting through his face. A tiny drop of liquid cement had been placed on the suspected nerve to keep a vein from pressing on it. A week later, he developed massive headaches. Nearly every test was run, but no diagnosis was ever identified. 4. Dozens of cases of head trauma, suicides, gunshots, bar fights, motorcycle accidents, car crashes, a moose attack. At moments, the weight of it all became palpable. It was in the air, the stress and misery. Normally, you breathed it in without noticing it. But some days, like a humid, muggy day, it had a suffocating weight of its own. Some days, this is how it felt when I was in the hospital, trapped in an endless jungle summer, wet with sweat, the rain of tears of the families of the dying pouring down. In the second year of training, you're the first to arrive in an emergency. Some patients you can't save. Others you can. The first time I rushed a comatose patient from the ER to the OR, drained the blood from his skull, and then watched him wake up, start talking to his family, and complain about the incision on his head, I got lost in a euphoric daze, promenading around the hospital at 2 a.m. until I had no sense of where I was. It took me 45 minutes to find my way back out. The schedule took a toll. As residents, we were working as much as 100 hours a week. Though regulations officially capped our hours at 88, there was always more work to be done. My eyes watered. My head throbbed. I downed energy drinks at 2 a.m. At work, I could keep it together, but as soon as I walked out of the hospital, the exhaustion would hit me. I staggered through the parking lot, often napping in my car before driving the 15 minutes home to bed. Not all residents could stand the pressure. One was simply unable to accept blame or responsibility. He was a talented surgeon, but he could not admit when he'd made a mistake. I sat with him one day in the lounge as he begged me to help him save his career. "All you have to do," I said, "is look me in the eye and say, 'I'm sorry. What happened was my fault, and I won't let it happen again.'" "But it was the nurse who..." "No. You have to be able to say it and mean it. Try again." "But..." "No. Say it." This went on for an hour before I knew he was doomed. The stress drove another resident out of the field entirely. She elected to leave for a less taxing job in consulting. Others would pay even higher prices. As my skills increased, so too did my responsibility. Learning to judge whose lives could be saved, whose couldn't be, and whose shouldn't be, requires an unattainable prognostic ability. I made mistakes. Rushing a patient to the OR to save only enough brain that his heart beats, but he can never speak. He eats through a tube, and he is condemned to an existence he would never want. I came to see this as a more egregious failure than the patient dying. The twilight existence of unconscious metabolism becomes an unbearable burden, usually left to an institution where the family, unable to attain closure, visits with increasing rarity until the inevitable fatal bedsore or pneumonia sets in. Some insist on this life and embrace its possibility, eyes open. But many do not or cannot, and the neurosurgeon must learn to adjudicate. I had started in this career, in part, to pursue death, to grasp it, uncloak it, and see it eye to eye, unblinking. Neurosurgery attracted me as much for its intertwining of brain and consciousness as for its intertwining of life and death. I had thought that a life spent in the space between the two would grant me not merely a stage for compassionate action, but an elevation of my own being. Getting as far away from petty materialism, from self-important trivia, getting right there, to the heart of the matter, to truly life-and-death decisions and struggles. Surely a kind of transcendence would be found there. But in residency, something else was gradually unfolding. In the midst of this endless barrage of head injuries, I began to suspect that being so close to the fiery light of such moments only blinded me to their nature. Like trying to learn astronomy by staring directly at the sun. I was not yet with patients in their pivotal moments. I was merely at those pivotal moments. I observed a lot of suffering. Worse, I became inured to it. Drowning, even in blood, one adapts, learns to float, to swim, even to enjoy life, bonding with the nurses, doctors, and others who are clinging to the same raft, caught in the same tide. My fellow resident Jeff and I worked traumas together. When he called me down to the trauma bay because of a concurrent head injury, we were always in sync. He'd assess the abdomen, then ask for my prognosis on a patient's cognitive function. "Well, he could still be a senator," I once replied, "but only from a small state." Jeff laughed, and from that moment on, state population became our barometer for head injury severity. "Is he a Wyoming or a California?" Jeff would ask, trying to determine how intensive his care plan should be. Or I'd say, "Jeff, I know his blood pressure is labile, but I gotta get him to the OR or he's gonna go from Washington to Idaho. Can you get him stabilized?" In the cafeteria one day, as I was grabbing my typical lunch, a Diet Coke and an ice cream sandwich, my pager announced an incoming major trauma. I ran to the trauma bay, tucking my ice cream sandwich behind a computer just as the paramedics arrived, pushing the gurney, reciting the details. 22-year-old male, motorcycle accident, 40 miles per hour, possible brain coming out his nose. I went straight to work, calling for an intubation tray, assessing his other vital functions. Once he was safely intubated, I surveyed his various injuries. The bruised face, the road rash, the dilated pupils. We pumped him full of mannitol to reduce brain swelling and rushed him to the scanner. A shattered skull, heavy diffuse bleeding. In my mind, I was already planning the scalp incision, how I'd drill the bone, evacuate the blood. His blood pressure suddenly dropped. We rushed him back to the trauma bay, and just as the rest of the trauma team arrived, his heart stopped. A whirlwind of activity surrounded him. Catheters were slipped into his femoral arteries, tubes shoved deep into his chest, drugs pushed into his IVs, and all the while, fists pounded on his heart to keep the blood flowing. After 30 minutes, we let him finish dying. With that kind of head injury, we all murmured in agreement. Death was to be preferred. I slipped out of the trauma bay just as the family was brought in to view the body. Then I remembered my Diet Coke, my ice cream sandwich, and the sweltering heat of the trauma bay. With one of the ER residents covering for me, I slipped back in, ghost-like, to save the ice cream sandwich in front of the corpse of the son I could not. 30 minutes in the freezer resuscitated the sandwich. Pretty tasty, I thought, picking chocolate chips out of my teeth as the family said its last goodbyes. I wondered if, in my brief time as a physician, I had made more moral slides than strides. A few days later, I heard that Lori, a friend from medical school, had been hit by a car and that a neurosurgeon had performed an operation to try to save her. She'd coded, was revived, and then died the following day. I didn't want to know more. The days when someone was simply killed in a car accident were long gone. Now those words opened a Pandora's box out of which emerged all the images. The roll of the gurney, the blood on the trauma bay floor, the tube shoved down her throat, the pounding on her chest. I could see hands, my hands, shaving Lori's scalp, the scalpel cutting open her head, could hear the frenzy of the drill and smell the burning bone, its dust whirling, the crack as I pried off a section of her skull. Her hair half-shaven, her head deformed. She failed to resemble herself at all. She became a stranger to her friends and family. Maybe there were chest tubes, and a leg was in traction. I didn't ask for details. I already had too many. In that moment, all my occasions of failed empathy came rushing back to me. The times I had pushed discharge over patient worries, ignored patient's pain when other demands pressed. The people whose suffering I saw, noted and neatly packaged into various diagnoses, the significance of which I failed to recognize. They all returned, vengeful, angry, and inexorable. I feared I was on the way to becoming Tolstoy's stereotype of a doctor, preoccupied with empty formalism, focused on the rote treatment of disease, and utterly missing the larger human significance. Doctors came to see her singly and in consultation, talked much in French, German, and Latin, blamed one another, and prescribed a great variety of medicines for all the diseases known to them. But the simple idea never occurred to any of them that they could not know the disease Natasha was suffering from. A mother came to me, newly diagnosed with brain cancer. She was confused, scared, overcome by uncertainty. I was exhausted, disconnected. I rushed through her questions, assured her that surgery would be a success, and assured myself that there wasn't enough time to answer her questions fairly. But why didn't I make the time? A truculent vet refused the advice and coaxing of doctors, nurses, and physical therapists for weeks. As a result, his back wound broke down, just as we had warned him it would. Called out of the OR, I stitched the dehiscent wound as he yelped in pain, telling myself he'd had it coming. Nobody has it coming. I took meager solace in knowing that William Carlos Williams and Richard Selzer had confessed to doing worse, and I swore to do better. Amid the tragedies and failures, I feared I was losing sight of the singular importance of human relationships, not between patients and their families, but between doctor and patient. Technical excellence was not enough. As a resident, my highest ideal was not saving lives, everyone dies eventually, but guiding a patient or family to an understanding of death or illness. When a patient comes in with a fatal head bleed, that first conversation with the neurosurgeon may forever color how the family remembers the death. From a peaceful letting go, maybe it was his time, to an open sore of regret. Those doctors didn't listen. They didn't even try to save him. When there's no place for the scalpel, words are the surgeon's only tool. For amid that unique suffering invoked by severe brain damage, the suffering often felt more by families than by patients, it is not merely the physicians who do not see the full significance. The families who gather around their beloved whose sheared heads contained battered brains, do not usually recognize the full significance either. They see the past, the accumulation of memories, the freshly felt love, all represented by the body before them. I see the possible futures, the breathing machines connected through a surgical opening in the neck, the pasty liquid dripping in through a hole in the belly, the possible long, painful, and only partial recovery, or, sometimes more likely, no return at all of the person they remember. In these moments, I acted not, as I most often did, as death's enemy, but as its ambassador. I had to help those families understand that the person they knew, the full, vital, independent human, now lived only in the past, and that I needed their input to understand what sort of future he or she would want. An easy death, or to be strung between bags of fluids going in, others coming out, to persist despite being unable to struggle. Had I been more religious in my youth, I might have become a pastor, for it was the pastoral role I'd sought. With my renewed focus, informed consent, the ritual by which a patient signs a piece of paper authorizing surgery, became not a juridical exercise in naming all the risks as quickly as possible, like the voiceover in an ad for a new pharmaceutical, but an opportunity to forge a covenant with a suffering compatriot. Here we are, together, and here are the ways through. I promise to guide you as best as I can to the other side. By this point in my residency, I was more efficient and experienced. I could finally breathe a little, no longer trying to hang on for my own dear life. I was now accepting full responsibility for my patient's well-being. My thoughts turned to my father. As medical students, Lucy and I had attended his hospital rounds in Kingman, watching as he brought comfort and levity to his patients. To one woman who was recovering from a cardiac procedure, "Are you hungry? What can I get you to eat?"
"Anything," she said. "I'm starving."
"Well, how about lobster and steak?" He picked up the phone and called the nursing station. "My patient needs lobster and steak, right away." Turning back to her, he said with a smile, "It's on the way, but it may look more like a turkey sandwich." The easy human connections he formed, the trust he instilled in his patients, were an inspiration to me. A 35-year-old sat in her ICU bed, a sheen of terror on her face. She had been shopping for her sister's birthday when she'd had a seizure. A scan showed that a benign brain tumor was pressing on her right frontal lobe. In terms of operative risk, it was the best kind of tumor to have, and the best place to have it. Surgery would almost certainly eliminate her seizures. The alternative was a lifetime on toxic anti-seizure medications. But I could see that the idea of brain surgery terrified her more than most. She was lonesome and in a strange place, having been swept out of the familiar hubbub of a shopping mall and into the alien beeps and alarms and antiseptic smells of an ICU. She would likely refuse surgery if I launched into a detached spiel detailing all the risks and possible complications. I could do so, document her refusal in the chart, consider my duty discharged, and move on to the next task. Instead, with her permission, I gathered her family with her, and together we calmly talked through the options. As we talked, I could see the enormousness of the choice she faced dwindle into a difficult but understandable decision. I had met her in a space where she was a person instead of a problem to be solved. She chose surgery. The operation went smoothly. She went home 2 days later and never seized again.
Any major illness transforms a patient's, really an entire family's, life. But brain diseases have the additional strangeness of the esoteric. A son's death already defies the parents' ordered universe. How much more incomprehensible is it when the patient is brain dead, his body warm, his heart still beating? The root of disaster means a star coming apart. And no image expresses better the look in a patient's eyes when hearing a neurosurgeon's diagnosis. Sometimes the news so shocks the mind that the brain suffers an electrical short. This phenomenon is known as a psychogenic syndrome, a severe version of the swoon some experience after hearing bad news. When my mother, alone at college, heard that her father, who had championed her right to an education in rural 1960s India, had finally died after a long hospitalization, she had a psychogenic seizure, which continued until she returned home to attend the funeral. One of my patients, upon being diagnosed with brain cancer, fell suddenly into a coma. I ordered a battery of labs, scans, and EEGs, searching for a cause, without result. The definitive test was the simplest. I raised the patient's arm above his face and let go. A patient in a psychogenic coma retains just enough volition to avoid hitting himself. The treatment consists in speaking reassuringly until your words connect and the patient awakens. Cancer of the brain comes in two varieties: primary cancers, which are born in the brain, and metastases, which emigrate from somewhere else in the body, most commonly from the lungs. Surgery does not cure the disease, but it does prolong life. For most people, cancer in the brain suggests death within a year, maybe two. Mrs. Lee was in her late 50s, with pale green eyes, and had transferred to my service 2 days earlier from a hospital near her home, 100 miles away. Her husband, his plaid shirt tucked into crisp jeans, stood by her bedside, fidgeting with his wedding ring. I introduced myself and sat down, and she told me her story. For the past few days, she had felt a tingling in her right hand, and then she'd begun to lose control of it, until she could no longer button her blouse. She'd gone to her local ER, fearing she was having a stroke. An MRI was obtained there, and she was sent here. "Did anyone tell you what the MRI showed?" I asked. "No." The buck had been passed, as it often was with difficult news. Oftentimes, we'd have a spat with the oncologist over whose job it was to break the news. How many times had I done the same? Well, I figured, it can stop here. "Okay," I said. "We have a lot to talk about. If you don't mind, can you tell me what you understand is happening? It's always helpful for me to hear, to make sure I don't leave anything unanswered." "Well, I thought I was having a stroke. But I guess I'm not?"
"That's right. You aren't having a stroke."
I paused. I could see the vastness of the chasm between the life she'd had last week and the one she was about to enter. She and her husband didn't seem ready to hear brain cancer. "Is anyone?" So I began a couple steps back. "The MRI shows a mass in your brain, which is causing your symptoms." Silence. "Do you want to see the MRI?"
"Yes."
I brought up the images on the bedside computer, pointing out her nose, eyes, and ears to orient her. Then I scrolled up to the tumor, a lumpy white ring surrounding a black necrotic core.
"What's that?" she asked.
"Could be anything. Maybe an infection. We won't know till after surgery."
My inclination to dodge the question still persisted, to let their obvious worries float in their heads, unpinned. "We can't be sure until after surgery," I began, "but it looks very much like a brain tumor."
"Is it cancer?"
Again,
We won't know for certain until it is removed and examined by our pathologists. But if I had to guess, I would say yes. Based on the scan, there was no doubt in my mind that this was glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer, the worst kind. Yet I proceeded softly, taking my cues from Mrs. Lee and her husband. Having introduced the possibility of brain cancer, I doubted they would recall much else. A tureen of tragedy was best allotted by the spoonful. Only a few patients demanded the whole at once. Most needed time to digest. They didn't ask about prognosis. Unlike in trauma, where you have only about 10 minutes to explain and make a major decision, here I could let things settle. I discussed in detail what to expect over the next couple of days, what the surgery entailed, how we'd shave only a small strip of her hair to keep it cosmetically appealing, how her arm would likely get a little weaker afterward, but then stronger again, that if all went well, she'd be out of the hospital in 3 days, that this was just the first step in a marathon, that getting rest was important, and that I didn't expect them to retain anything I had just said, and we'd go over everything again. After surgery, we talked again, this time discussing chemo, radiation, and prognosis. By this point, I had learned a couple of basic rules. First, detailed statistics are for research halls, not hospital rooms. The standard statistic, the Kaplan-Meier curve, measures the number of patients surviving over time. It is the metric by which we gauge progress, by which we understand the ferocity of a disease. For glioblastoma, the curve drops sharply until only about 5% of patients are alive at 2 years. Second, it is important to be accurate, but you must always leave some room for hope. Rather than saying median survival is 11 months, or you have a 95% chance of being dead in 2 years, I'd say most patients live many months to a couple of years. This was, to me, a more honest description. The problem is that you can't tell an individual patient where she sits on the curve. Will she die in 6 months or 60? I came to believe that it is irresponsible to be more precise than you can be accurate. Those apocryphal doctors who gave specific numbers, a doctor told me I had 6 months to live. Who were they, I wondered, and who taught them statistics? Patients, when hearing the news, mostly remain mute. One of the early meanings of patient, after all, is one who endures hardship without complaint. Whether out of dignity or shock, silence usually reigns, and so holding a patient's hand becomes the mode of communication. A few immediately harden, usually the spouse rather than the patient. "We're gonna fight and beat this thing, Doc." The armament varies from prayer to wealth, to herbs, to stem cells. To me, that hardness always seems brittle. Unrealistic optimism, the only alternative to crushing despair. In any case, in the immediacy of surgery, a warlike attitude fit. In the OR, the dark gray rotting tumor seemed an invader in the fleshy peach convolutions of the brain, and I felt real anger. "Got you, you fucker," I muttered. Removing the tumor was satisfying, even though I knew that microscopic cancer cells had already spread throughout that healthy-looking brain. The nearly inevitable recurrence was a problem for another day. A spoonful at a time. Openness to human relationality does not mean revealing grand truths from the apps. It means meeting patients where they are, in the narthex or nave, and bringing them as far as you can. Yet openness to human relationality also carried a price. One evening in my 3rd year, I ran into Jeff, my friend in general surgery, a similarly intense and demanding profession. We each noted the other's despondency. "You go first," he said. And I described the death of a child,
shot in the head for wearing the wrong color shoes. But he had been so close to making it. Amid a recent spate of fatal, inoperable brain tumors, my hopes had been pinned on this kid pulling through. And he hadn't. Jeff paused, and I awaited his story. Instead, he laughed, punched me in the arm, and said, "Well, I guess I learned one thing. If I'm ever feeling down about my work, I can always talk to a neurosurgeon to cheer myself up." Driving home later that night, after gently explaining to a mother that her newborn had been born without a brain and would die shortly, I switched on the radio. NPR was reporting on the continuing drought in California. Suddenly, tears were streaming down my face. Being with patients in these moments certainly had its emotional cost, but it also had its rewards. I don't think I ever spent a minute of any day wondering why I did this work or whether it was worth it. The call to protect life, and not merely life, but another's identity, it is perhaps not too much to say another's soul, was obvious in its sacredness. Before operating on a patient's brain, I realized, I must first understand his mind, his identity, his values, what makes his life worth living, and what devastation makes it reasonable to let that life end. The cost of my dedication to succeed was high, and the ineluctable failures brought me nearly unbearable guilt. Those burdens are what make medicine holy, and wholly impossible. In taking up another's cross, one must sometimes get crushed by the weight. Midway through residency, time is set aside for additional training. Perhaps unique in medicine, the ethos of neurosurgery, of excellence in all things, maintains that excellence in neurosurgery alone is not enough. In order to carry the field, neurosurgeons must venture forth and excel in other fields as well. Sometimes this is very public, as in the case of neurosurgeon journalist Sanjay Gupta. But most often, the doctor's focus is on a related field. The most rigorous and prestigious path is that of the neurosurgeon neuroscientist. In my fourth year, I began work in a Stanford lab dedicated to basic motor neuroscience and the development of neural prosthetic technology that would allow, say, paralyzed people to mentally control a computer cursor or robot arm. The head of the lab, a professor of electrical engineering and neurobiology, a fellow second-generation Indian, was affectionately called V by everyone. V was 7 years older than I, but we got on like brothers. His lab had become a world leader in reading out brain signals, but with his blessing, I embarked on a project to do the reverse, to write signals into the brain. After all, if your robot arm can't feel how hard it's grasping a wine glass, you will break a lot of wine glasses. The implications of writing signals into the brain, or neuromodulation, however, were far more wide-reaching than that. Being able to control neural firing would conceivably allow treatment of a host of currently untreatable or intractable neurological and psychiatric diseases, from major depression to Huntington's to schizophrenia to Tourette's to OCD. The possibilities were limitless. Putting surgery aside now, I set to work learning to apply new techniques in gene therapy in a series of first-of-its-kind experiments. After I'd been there for a year, V and I sat down for one of our weekly meetings. I had grown to love these chats. V was not like other scientists I knew. He was soft-spoken and cared deeply about people and the clinical mission, and he often confessed to me that he wished he'd been a surgeon himself. Science, I had come to learn, is as political, competitive, and fierce a career as you can find, full of the temptation to find easy paths. One could count on V to always choose the honest and often self-effacing way forward. While most scientists connive to publish in the most prestigious journals and get their names out there, V maintained that our only obligation was to be authentic to the scientific story and to tell it uncompromisingly. I'd never met someone so successful who was also so committed to goodness. V was an actual paragon. Instead of smiling as I sat down across from him, he looked pained. He sighed and said, "I need you to wear your doctor hat right now." "Okay." "They tell me I have pancreatic cancer." "V." "Okay, tell me the story." He laid out his gradual weight loss, indigestion, and his recent precautionary CT scan, a truly non-standard procedure at this point, which showed a pancreatic mass. We discussed the way forward, the dreaded Whipple operation in his near future. "You are going to feel like a truck hit you," I told him. Who the best surgeons were, the impact the illness would have on his wife and children, and how to run the lab during his prolonged absence. Pancreatic cancer has a dismal prognosis, but of course, there was no way to know what that meant for V. He paused. "Paul," he said, "do you think my life has meaning? Did I make the right choices?" It was stunning. Even someone I considered a moral exemplar had these questions in the face of mortality. V's surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatments were trying, but a success. He was back at work a year later, just as I was returning to my clinical duties in the hospital. His hair had thinned and whitened, and the spark in his eyes had dulled. During our final weekly chat, he turned to me and said, "You know, today is the first day it all seems worth it. I mean, obviously I would have gone through anything for my kids, but today is the first day that all the suffering seems worth it." How little do doctors understand the hells through which we put patients? In my sixth year, I returned to the hospital full-time, my research in V's lab now relegated to days off and idle moments, such as they were. Most people, even your closest colleagues, don't quite understand the black hole that is neurosurgical residency. One of my favorite nurses, after sticking around until 10 p.m. one night to help us finish a long and difficult case, said to me, "Thank God I have tomorrow off. Do you too?" No. "But at least you can come in later or something, right? When do you usually get in?" 6 a.m. "No, really?" "Yup. Every day?" "Every day." "Weekends too?" "Don't ask." In residency, there's a saying, "The days are long, but the years are short." In neurosurgical residency, the day usually began at 6 a.m. and lasted until the operating was done, which depended, in part, on how quick you were in the OR. A resident's surgical skill is judged by his technique and his speed. You can't be sloppy, and you can't be slow. From your first wound closure onward, spend too much time being precise, and the scrub tech will announce, "Looks like we've got a plastic surgeon on our hands." Or, "I get your strategy. By the time you finish sewing the top half of the wound, the bottom will have healed on its own. Half the work. Very smart." A chief resident will advise a junior, "Learn to be fast now. You can learn to be good later." In the OR, everyone's eyes are always on the clock. For the patient's sake, how long has he been under anesthesia? During long procedures, nerves can get damaged. Muscles can break down, kidneys can fail. For everyone else's sake, what time are we getting out of here tonight? I could see that there were two strategies to cutting the time short, perhaps best exemplified by the tortoise and the hare. The hare moves as fast as possible, hands a blur, instruments clattering, falling to the floor. The skin slips open like a curtain. The skull flap is on the tray before the bone dust settles. As a result, the opening might need to be expanded a centimeter here or there because it's not optimally placed. The tortoise, on the other hand,
proceeds deliberately, with no wasted movements, measuring twice, cutting once. No step of the operation needs revisiting. Everything moves in a precise, orderly fashion. If the hare makes too many minor missteps and has to keep adjusting, the tortoise wins. If the tortoise spends too much time planning each step, the hare wins. The funny thing about time in the OR, whether you race frenetically or proceed steadily, is that you have no sense of it passing. If boredom is, as Heidegger argued, the awareness of time passing, then surgery felt like the opposite. The intense focus made the arms of the clock seem arbitrarily placed. 2 hours could feel like a minute. Once the final stitch was placed and the wound was dressed, normal time suddenly restarted. You could almost hear an audible whoosh. Then you started wondering, how long until the patient wakes up? How long until the next case is rolled in? And what time will I get home tonight? It wasn't until the last case was finished that I felt the length of the day, the drag in my step. Those last few administrative tasks before leaving the hospital were like anvils. Could it wait until tomorrow? No. A sigh, and Earth continued to rotate back toward the sun. As a chief resident, nearly all responsibility fell on my shoulders, and the opportunities to succeed or fail were greater than ever. The pain of failure had led me to understand that technical excellence was a moral requirement. Good intentions were not enough, not when so much depended on my skills, when the difference between tragedy and triumph was defined by 1 or 2 millimeters. One day, Matthew, the little boy with the brain tumor who had charmed the ward a few years back, was readmitted. His hypothalamus had, in fact, been slightly damaged during the operation to remove his tumor. The adorable 8-year-old was now a 12-year-old monster. He never stopped eating. He threw violent fits. His mother's arms were scarred with purple scratches. Eventually, Matthew was institutionalized. He had become a demon, summoned by 1 millimeter of damage. For every surgery, a family and a surgeon decide together that the benefits outweigh the risks. But this was still heartbreaking. No one wanted to think about what Matthew would be like as a 300-pound 20-year-old. Another day, I placed an electrode 9 centimeters deep in a patient's brain to treat a Parkinson's tremor. The target was the subthalamic nucleus, a tiny almond-shaped structure deep in the brain. Different parts of it subserve different functions: movement, cognition, emotion. In the operating room, we turned on the current to assess the tremor. With all our eyes on the patient's left hand, we agreed the tremor looked better. Then, the patient's voice, confused, rose above our affirmative murmurs. "I feel overwhelmingly sad."
"Current off," I said.
"Oh, now the feeling is going away," the patient said. "Let's recheck the current and impedance, okay?" "Okay, current on." "No, everything, it just feels so sad, just dark, and sad."
"Electrode out."
We pulled the electrode out and reinserted it, this time 2 millimeters to the right. The tremor went away. The patient felt, thankfully, fine. Once, I was doing a late-night case with one of the neurosurgery attendings, a suboccipital craniectomy for a brainstem malformation. It's one of the most elegant surgeries, and perhaps the most difficult part of the body. Just getting there is tricky, no matter how experienced you are. But that night, I felt fluid. The instruments were like extensions of my fingers. The skin, muscle, and bone seemed to unzip themselves. And there I was, staring at a yellow, glistening bulge, a mass deep in the brainstem. Suddenly, the attending stopped me.
Paul, what happens if you cut 2 millimeters deeper right here?
He pointed.
Neuroanatomy slides whirred through my head.
Double vision?
No, he said. Locked-in syndrome.
Another 2 millimeters, and the patient would be completely paralyzed, save for the ability to blink.
He didn't look up from the microscope.
And I know this because the third time I did this operation, that's exactly what happened.
Neurosurgery requires a commitment to one's own excellence and a commitment to another's identity. The decision to operate at all involves an appraisal of one's own abilities, as well as a deep sense of who the patient is and what she holds dear. Certain brain areas are considered near inviolable, like the primary motor cortex, damage to which results in paralysis of affected body parts. But the most sacrosanct regions of the cortex are those that control language. Usually located on the left side, they are called Wernicke's and Broca's areas. One is for understanding language, and the other for producing it. Damage to Broca's area results in an inability to speak or write, though the patient can easily understand language. Damage to Wernicke's area results in an inability to understand language. Though the patient can still speak, the language she produces is a stream of unconnected words, phrases, and images. A grammar without semantics. If both areas are damaged, the patient becomes an isolate, something central to her humanity stolen forever. After someone suffers a head trauma or a stroke, the destruction of these areas often restrains the surgeon's impulse to save a life.
What kind of life exists without language?
When I was a med student, the first patient I met with this sort of problem was a 62-year-old man with a brain tumor. We strolled into his room on morning rounds, and the resident asked him, "Mr. Michaels, how are you feeling today?"
461819, he replied, somewhat affably.
The tumor had interrupted his speech circuitry, so he could speak only in streams of numbers. But he still had prosody. He could still emote. Smile, scowl, sigh. He recited another series of numbers, this time with urgency. There was something he wanted to tell us, but the digits could communicate nothing other than his fear and fury. The team prepared to leave the room. For some reason, I lingered.
14128, he pleaded with me, holding my hand. 14128.
I'm sorry. 14128, he said mournfully, staring into my eyes. And then I left to catch up to the team. He died a few months later, buried with whatever message he had for the world. When tumors or malformations abut these language areas, the surgeon takes numerous precautions, ordering a host of different scans, a detailed neuropsychological examination. Critically, however, the surgery is performed with the patient awake and talking. Once the brain is exposed, but before the tumor excision, the surgeon uses a handheld ball-tip electrode to deliver electrical current to stun a small area of the cortex while the patient performs various verbal tasks, naming objects, reciting the alphabet, and so on. When the electrode sends current into a critical piece of cortex, it disrupts the patient's speech. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. The brain and the tumor are thus mapped to determine what can be resected safely, and the patient is kept awake throughout, occupied with a combination of formal verbal tasks and small talk. One evening, as I was prepping for one of these cases, I reviewed the patient's MRI and noted that the tumor completely covered the language areas. Not a good sign. Reviewing the notes, I saw that the hospital's tumor board,
an expert panel of surgeons, oncologists, radiologists, and pathologists had deemed the case too dangerous for surgery.
How could the surgeon have opted to proceed?
I became a little indignant. At a certain point, it was our job to say no. The patient was wheeled into the room. He fixed his eyes on me and pointed to his head.
I want this thing out of my fucking brain. Got it?
The attending strolled in and saw the expression on my face.
I know, he said. I tried talking him out of this for about 2 hours. Don't bother. Ready to go?
Instead of the usual alphabet recital or counting exercise, we were treated, throughout the surgery, to a litany of profanity and exhortation.
Is that fucking thing out of my head yet? Why are you slowing down? Go faster! I want it out! I can stay here all fucking day. I don't care. Just get it out!
I slowly removed the enormous tumor, attentive to the slightest hint of speech difficulty. With the patient's monologue unceasing, the tumor now sat on a petri dish, his clean brain gleaming.
Why'd you stop? You some kind of asshole? I told you I want the fucking thing gone!
It's done, I said. It's out.
How was he still talking? Given the size and location of the tumor, it seemed impossible. Profanity supposedly ran on a slightly different circuit from the rest of language. Perhaps the tumor had caused his brain to rewire somehow. But the skull wasn't going to close itself. There would be time for speculation tomorrow. I had reached the pinnacle of residency. I had mastered the core operations. My research had garnered the highest awards. Job interest was trickling in from all over the country. Stanford launched a search for a position that fit my interests exactly, for a neurosurgeon-neuroscientist focused on techniques of neural modulation. One of my junior residents came up to me and said,
"I just heard from the bosses. If they hire you, you're going to be my faculty mentor."
"Shh," I said. "Don't jinx it."
It felt to me as if the individual strands of biology, morality, life, and death were finally beginning to weave themselves into, if not a perfect moral system, a coherent worldview and a sense of my place in it. Doctors in highly charged fields met patients at inflected moments, the most authentic moments, where life and identity were under threat. Their duty included learning what made that particular patient's life worth living, and planning to save those things if possible, or to allow the peace of death if not. Such power required deep responsibility, sharing in guilt and recrimination. I was at a conference in San Diego when my phone rang. My co-resident, Victoria.
"Paul?"
Something was wrong. My stomach tightened.
"What's up?" I said.
Silence.
"Vic?"
"It's Jeff. He killed himself."
"What?"
Jeff was finishing his surgical fellowship in the Midwest, and we were both so punishingly busy, we'd lost touch. I tried to recall our last conversation, and couldn't.
He apparently had a difficult complication, and his patient died. Last night he climbed onto the roof of a building and jumped off. I don't really know anything else."
I searched for a question to bring understanding. None was forthcoming. I could only imagine the overwhelming guilt, like a tidal wave, that had lifted him up and off that building. I wished, desperately, that I could have been walking with him out the door of the hospital that evening. I wished we could have commiserated as we used to. I wished I could have told Jeff what I had come to understand about life and our chosen way of life, if only to hear his wise, clever counsel. Death comes for all of us. For us, for our patients. It is our fate, as living, breathing, metabolizing organisms. Most lives are lived with passivity toward death. It's something that happens to you
and those around you. But Jeff and I had trained for years to actively engage with death, to grapple with it, like Jacob with the angel, and in so doing, to confront the meaning of a life. We had assumed an onerous yoke, that of mortal responsibility. Our patients' lives and identities may be in our hands, yet death always wins. Even if you are perfect, the world isn't. The secret is to know that the deck is stacked, that you will lose, that your hands or judgment will slip, and yet still struggle to win for your patients. You can't ever reach perfection, but you can believe in an asymptote toward which you are ceaselessly striving.
Part 2. Cease not till death. If I were a writer of books, I would compile a register with a comment of the various deaths of men. He who should teach men to die would at the same time teach them to live. Michel de Montaigne. That to study philosophy is to learn to die. Lying next to Lucy in the hospital bed, both of us crying, the CT scan images still glowing on the computer screen, that identity as a physician, my identity, no longer mattered. With the cancer having invaded multiple organ systems, the diagnosis was clear. The room was quiet. Lucy told me she loved me. "I don't want to die," I said. I told her to remarry, that I couldn't bear the thought of her being alone. I told her we should refinance the mortgage immediately. We started calling family members. At some point, Victoria came by the room, and we discussed the scan and the likely future treatments. When she brought up the logistics of returning to residency, I stopped her. "Victoria," I said, "I'm never coming back to this hospital as a doctor. Don't you think?" One chapter of my life seemed to have ended. Perhaps the whole book was closing. Instead of being the pastoral figure aiding a life transition, I found myself the sheep, lost and confused. Severe illness wasn't life-altering. It was life-shattering. It felt less like an epiphany, a piercing burst of light illuminating what really matters, and more like someone had just firebombed the path forward. Now I would have to work around it. My brother Jeevan had arrived at my bedside. "You've accomplished so much," he said. "You know that, don't you?" I sighed. He meant well, but the words rang hollow. My life had been building potential, potential that would now go unrealized. I had planned to do so much, and I had come so close. I was physically debilitated. My imagined future and my personal identity collapsed, and I faced the same existential quandaries my patients faced. The lung cancer diagnosis was confirmed. My carefully planned and hard-won future no longer existed. Death, so familiar to me in my work, was now paying a personal visit. Here we were, finally face to face, and yet nothing about it seemed recognizable. Standing at the crossroads, where I should have been able to see and follow the footprints of the countless patients I had treated over the years, I saw instead only a blank, a harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert, as if a sandstorm had erased all trace of familiarity. The sun was setting. I would be discharged the next morning. An oncology appointment was set for later in the week, but the nurse told me my oncologist was going to drop by that night before leaving to pick up her kids. Her name was Emma Hayward, and she wanted to say hello before the initial office visit. I knew Emma a little. I had treated some of her patients before, but we had never spoken beyond passing professional courtesies. My parents and brothers were scattered about the room, not saying much, while Lucy sat by the bed, holding my hand.
The door opened, and in she walked, her white coat showing the wear of a long day, but her smile fresh.
Trailing behind her